Good morning and welcome to the Greenwich Entrepreneurs Podcast. I'm here with Pedro Ramirez, who is a wealth manager here at Bellray. And,
morning, Greg.
Keeps me company. Good morning, Pedro.
Good rainy morning.
Yes, yes. And I'm Greg Skidmore, president of Bellray, and we are here with another great entrepreneur, your doctor. I just noticed that.
Yeah.
So he's smart, too.
Not necessarily.
His name is Homayoun Beghi.
That's correct, yes.
Oh, good. Got it. All right. And his firm is Recognition Technologies. And what I think is really interesting is that you came out of IBM. And in this area, we have a lot of really great entrepreneurs that come out of IBM. So we have another one. So good morning.
Welcome. Good morning.
So why don't you just start off and tell us a little bit about your firm, and then we'll get into the details.
Sure. Recognition Technologies was started in around 2002-2003. It's not a very big company. I mean, we're only three people. I do most of the technical work. It's a research organization, I would say. It's very close to pure research, as close as you can get to pure research and still make some profit. We work on speaker recognition mostly. Mm-hmm. We do all sorts of different types of sort of biometrics and recognition, but mostly speaker recognition. And, you know, I should clarify what speaker recognition is at some point. I don't know if this is the time.
Yeah, go for it.
Even people who are in the sort of speech community sometimes mistake speaker recognition for speech recognition. It's really the biometric approach to try to find out who the person is based on the person's voice. When you pick up the phone and one of your relatives calls, most of the time you can recognize who the person is.
Mm.
And this is really what it tries to do. That's called identification, when they don't say who they are, but you can actually find out from their voice, oh, you know, it's a cousin that you haven't spoken to for a year. And so, oh, is this, you know, Mike? And then, you know, you start talking. So that's really speaker identification, which is a branch of speaker recognition.
So this is the kind of stuff that we'll see in, like, The Matrix and other, you know.
I was thinking
features.
Star Trek.
Yeah.
Computer.
Yeah.
And then you can,
that's
you
true.
Can,
you've seen,
you can
you've
talk to
actually
the computer.
Seen these for a long time. You've seen them in for example, Sneakers. I don't know if you've seen that movie. In the movie.
Robert Redford.
Right, okay. Right. The Mission Impossibles.
Oh, but that,
the
that's
new
what,
ones.
That's, yeah.
You know, where they use this device that they put on their throat and it changes the voice
that
so that
possible,
they can.
By the way.
Everything's possible,
okay.
but really to change,
question.
Yeah, I mean, to change the characteristics of your voice based on this, I don't know. I mean, how practical it is at this point, it's not, of course,
yeah.
but
it looks cool.
It looks cool.
It looks very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, one of the, I don't have a lot of experience with your, specific technology other than one of the most amazing things. I used to work with a research firm. And one of the companies they covered was working on providing basically signature recognition for the military. So in other words, the idea was every object has its own signature, and that comes from sound, other patterns. So they wanted to know that if that was the bad guy's Jeep, that they didn't want to hit any other Jeep but that one.
That's true. Actually, that's one of the things that our engine does as well.
Mm-hmm.
Remember I said speaker recognition is sort of the broad category. Speaker identification is one of them. So let me just give you a little bit overview of what the different categories are, things that sort of subcategories of speaker recognition. We call it speaker recognition, but it's really audio recognition.
Okay.
You know, any type of audio.
Sound
recognition. Speaker identification is the example that I gave you. Another very important example that's sort of seeing some interest these days is speaker verification, which means that you actually identify yourself with some sort of an ID, either a username or your actual name or, you know, something in that matter.
And the security system.
And the system actually compares you to a model it's seen of your voice, you know, your voice when you actually enrolled in the past, and it decides if you are indeed that person. So mm-hmm. I would come up and say, this is Homayoun Beghi. So it's hearing that I am Homayoun Beghi, which is the content of my speech, but it also gets the vocal characteristics of my voice. and compares that, pulls up a model of Humayun Begi's speech, and then has a model of other types of people, you know, other males, other in the society, all sorts of different models that it has based on statistics. And it compares this model to that model that it's stored before.
Hmm.
And if I'm sufficiently close, it says, yes, I verified. You know, it lets me get into a bank vault or do whatever I have to do.
Right,
it's
right.
A sort of security problem. So that's speaker verification. Another thing that you were talking about is called speaker or, you know, event classification.
Okay.
Which is, you know, you hear a sound. They do this for, like, submarines also. Mm-hmm. They want to pick up the signature of a submarine under the sea, and you know there are all sorts of different noises in the water, and they want to find out if there's a submarine coming their way or something like that. So, or you could, as you said, you know, listen in for a vehicle or maybe a gunshot. Let's say you have cameras, you know, all these cameras that we see all over the place these days and sort of proliferating. If they have microphones on them, there's no reason why they should be recording all the time, because there's just massive amounts of video
right,
that you don't have storage for.
Right.
What they can do is they can, if what they usually do is there, if there's anything moving in the scene, they start recording. But now imagine in New York City, there's always something,
well, there's
moving,
always something moving.
Right?
Right, right, right.
So what if you were sort of listening in for a specific sound, something that would trigger the thing, like a gunshot,
like
or
gunshot,
a bomb or whatever, something that's loud or something that you've sort of trained the system on. That's a good security system also, which
sure.
sort of reduces the amount of storage that you need, and it'll focus you on that specific camera mm-hmm. where the thing is the activity is happening. Or maybe you keep something in the buffer and you just keep it if there isn't the sort of audio attached to it, because if a bomb explodes, it's usually too late, but maybe you keep the last few minutes, and as soon as you hear that, you decide that this is something that's important, you just keep that piece of video, you know, from the past 2 minutes or whatever.
So that's really speaker recognition. And
we call it speaker recognition as a whole.
So
speaker classification,
speech recognition, which might be how your cell phone dials a number if you talk into it or something like that.
That's correct, yeah.
Speech okay.
recognition is it's the actual content of your speech. And
right.
In fact, they're looking at two opposite problems. What they're looking at is, in speech recognition, you're trying to filter out anything related to the speaker. You're going
right.
to try to...
Like the accent.
As if everybody's really the same person,
right,
and you're
right.
trying to figure out what the content of speech is. In speaker recognition, you don't care what they say.
Which is the opposite.
Which is exactly the opposite.
Yeah.
And in fact, you know, our brains process them differently in different hemispheres.
Hmm.
If you're a right-handed person, you process language-related things in your left hemisphere, in the audio cortex, you know, close to the audio cortex, in what they call Brodmann's area. And then what you would do is then speaker recognition is done on your right hemisphere, which is where you process music, you process tempo, you know, process things that are sort of suprasegmental. They're not,
right.
you know, specific. So it's even different parts of our brain that work on these different issues.
So the applications of these are incredible. I mean, even in our times where it's a security camera or trying to pick up something from a security point of view, verifying who, if the person on a video is really that person.
Oh, they're infinite. I can give you like examples like tracking, you know, speaker tracking. Right now we're talking in a conference, you know, basically there are three of us sitting here in front of mics. So let's say you were only interested in what Pedro said and you're interested in what I'm saying. So
right.
you want to really just extract. Sure. So you want to extract his voice. What you would want to do, that would actually be a speaker segmentation. And so it's really speaker indexing.
Right.
So you take a conference call where everything's multiplexed into one audio file, and you try to separate these different speakers, which is another part of the engine.
So right now, you have to record the track separately, in other
yes.
words, to handle that now. But you're saying a little bit down the road, they might be able to separate those
but
after
you know,
the fact.
That's impossible right now in the venue we're sitting around the table.
Because
your mic is picking up some of my voice
that's
as well,
true.
Right?
That's true, right.
So even if you separated the tracks, you're still getting some spillover from the other mics coming through, unless you actually put me in a bubble and you
put
us all
in separate soundproof rooms.
Right,
that'd be conducive.
Or cone of silence, as Maxwell Smart used to have.
Yes, the cone of silence.
So, just to remind everybody, we are talking to Dr. Homayoun Beji.
Beji.
And his. You should visit his website, which is www.recognitiontechnologies.com. You know, one of the things I'm sort of curious about is what you're doing sounds, you know, very academic. So I'm wondering, how do you make money?
What are the applications?
Yeah,
exactly?
How do you make money?
Because they sound like they're numerous. But
there are a lot of applications. The way we're making money right now is we have actually one major client, which is a language proficiency company in White Plains, based in White Plains. And what they do is they do proficiency testing for, I don't know, 50, 60 different languages. And for that reason, it's important that we are actually language independent. What we do is completely language independent. So you can train the system in one language and test it in another language. It'll still
really
work. Because
okay.
only your vocal characteristics cares about. So now you can imagine, let's say you're an Indian company trying to do sort of telephone support for the U.S. And you're supposed to show that the people working for you have certain level of proficiency in their language, in the English language. You can't just, you know, people won't just take your word for it. Somebody has to test them. So these people, what they do is they test different, you know, people who are trying to get employed, either a whole division or individuals who are trying to, let's say, get a job with the U.S. Postal Service, and they need to know Spanish. So they want to make sure that this guy put the right thing in the resume and didn't just, you know, I'm fluent in Spanish. That's mm-hmm. not really enough.
Right.
So what they do is the candidates are scheduled in to talk remotely to a tester. And the candidate calls our IVR system, Interactive Voice Response System, which is, again, a product of our company. They call in. The system asks them for an ID, for the test ID. Once they enter the test ID, it finds in the database, it looks for the tester's telephone number, calls the tester, puts the two in a conference call, and then records their conversation. So then what it does is it allows other raters to come in and listen to this conversation and give it a rating, you know, what they think the fluency of this person is. Now, what they used to do before they started working with us is they used to have these analog tape recorders hooked up to a telephone receiver at the tester site. The candidate would call these people. They would give the phone number of the tester. The person would then call the tester. The tester would turn on the recorder, record half an hour of conversation, ship it using FedEx to their center. They would duplicate it, send it to raters. Raters would actually rate it.
Yeah.
And so it would take close to like 2-3 weeks to do this.
Wow.
To each. Right now, as soon as the conversation is finished, the rater goes in and listens in and rates it. So within an hour, you've got your results. But the question is now, let's say you are sitting in India and you're calling somebody in Michigan who's the tester. How are they going to know that this is you and it's not a friend of yours who's sitting
right.
there and taking the test for you? So what they do is when these people actually register to take the test, at that point they have to meet somebody, they have to fill out an application. What they do is they pick up the phone, have them call in into our system. They will put in an ID for them. They'll speak for about a minute. They'll say, you know, they'll ask them to say something so that they won't be sort of locked out and they won't be able to say anything.
They'll
read something, or it doesn't matter what they read. Then they go home. And when it's time for the test, they'll call into the system. The first thing we do is we verify that they're the actual candidate. Once they verify, we'll patch them through.
Wow.
And in fact, what we're doing right now is trying to do this live as well, because they can actually, after the first verification, they can hand off the phone to some, you know, a friend.
So they can do that.
So we can actually check, segment the audio as they're speaking, and we know who our tester is. So we just filter out the tester. The candidate is the one that's left, and then we can verify that this is the same person that stayed on the phone.
Oh, I see. Right. The person. You're right.
So that's actually a very good application.
That leads me to a question. I'm sort of curious about something. You know, so you sign your signature to a piece of paper.
Mm-hmm.
in theory, if someone practices enough, they can they can copy your signature pretty accurately, and it would be pretty hard to pick up. Maybe a professional could pick it up. You know, when comedians copy voices and it sounds to us just like the real person's voice, is it possible to trick?
I'll tell you something. The interesting thing is, remember we talked about the different hemispheres of the brain?
Yeah.
The hemisphere we use to do speaker recognition is the part where we use to understand pitch and tempo and things like that.
Yeah.
So because they're all interconnected, we're really looking for these specific nuances in the speech. Whereas in speaker recognition, the technology that we use, it's looking at completely different characteristics. It's looking at the, different fundamental frequencies in the vocal tract. So even if you're trying to change your voice, you can only do so much. You can change maybe one or two of the frequencies that are important. Some of the fundamental frequencies you can't change because it's really your voice box.
That's interesting.
So, I mean, it's not that it's foolproof. You could make mistakes, and usually people use it in conjunction with other things like information, like information that you would only know.
But it's not as easy to trick as one might think if they were just casually thinking about it.
That's true. One of the tests that I usually do is when I demo the system is I try to change my voice.
Okay.
And I'll ask the person to try to mimic my voice. Of course, they're not professionals, but they try.
That must be funny when you get people to try.
It is. In fact, it's very funny when I try to change my voice. So, but that's what you got to do to be able to capture some attention.
So let's go back to the business end of things.
Yeah.
You have two other people that work at your firm.
Yeah.
Are they partners or employees or?
One of them is a partner and the other one is an employee.
Got it. And so your partner, she,
and she's actually my wife.
Okay.
So this is
partner,
sort of a family.
Capital P.
Yes. Yes.
And her name starts with a P also.
So what is her role in the business? What does she focus on?
She does, we, like anything else, we have interface issues, in terms of like GUIs, graphic user interfaces and things like that. And she's also an engineer. We're both Columbia graduates. And she concentrates on sort of the aesthetics of the interface with the software, and of course it's an engine, but still we do have some interfaces like administration backends and things like that. So she concentrates on those applications, things that are user, other than speech, sort of conversational part of things. It's whatever visual.
Did you guys start it together, or did she join you later, or did she start it and then you joined her?
It has a history. The thing is, we have another company called Internet Server Connections, which is a hosting company.
Got it.
We started that one in 96 when she graduated from Columbia.
Okay.
And she basically did a lot of things related to hosting, a lot of graphics and, websites and stuff like that. So in 2002, I left IBM in 2000 on a one-year sabbatical, and then in 2001 I sort of made it permanent, and in 2002 we decided to sort of start this company, and I continued the things that I was doing at IBM. So it was sort of a natural thing, where she joined me at the start, at the beginning. But I was actually, in the beginning, I was just doing a lot of algorithmic stuff, so she wasn't doing as much in the beginning.
Now, do both of you have parents that owned their own businesses? I mean, where does this sort of entrepreneurial thing come from?
She does. I don't. I'm from a long line of people who've worked for somebody else.
Okay.
My grandfather was an accountant. My father was in the government. No, we don't have any entrepreneurial thing on my side. She does, actually. They're jewelers. So
do you think that she has some of, because what I've found is that, it's very different to have the skills to get employed by somebody else and to stay employed than it is to run your own business. often the characteristics that allow you to be successful in running your own business can get you fired. So what has it been like? I would imagine you've learned some things from your wife in running a business. And what has it been like to transition from sort of a corporate environment to an entrepreneurial environment?
It wasn't very hard because although I started, you know, right out of school, I started working for IBM. Mm-hmm. But prior to that, when I was doing my PhD, I used to do a lot of programming for companies. So I just sort of to help out in sort of daily sort of income. I used to write inventory programs and multi-user inventory programs for large wholesale companies and things like that. At the time, Windows was a new thing. So I was actually working with Unix, which allowed people to do multi-user environments where nobody else could really touch. So I had some of this in me sort of from the beginning. And I had time to experiment with it because actually, you know what? A lot of the code that I'm using mm-hmm. is still from the 80s that I wrote, you know, developed for doing mathematical things, for doing, you know, a lot of things that don't change, you know, sort of libraries that keep building up.
Are you the same age as like Bill Gates, roughly? How old is
he? I don't know how old he is.
My official answer is duh.
Well, I know, but with the way the reason why I'm going with this is I'm sort of curious that his age group mm-hmm. produced a whole bunch of programmers that have been very influential in the development of technology. You know, we talked about Malcolm Gladwell before. He has this book called Outliers.
Right.
And his point is that there was a period of time where if you began programming in that, you sort of had a huge advantage because computers finally became efficient enough for you to actually get stuff done.
But I'll tell you something. I don't know what his age is, but I was just turned 17 when I started college. It was like a month into my 17th birthday. And I started, I was an engineer, so I started learning Fortran. And at Columbia, I remember when I entered, this was in 81, mm-hmm. They were just, this was the last semester they were using punch cards. And I entered when they had just bought these digital DEC 20 machines, which were terminal oriented. So, yeah, I mean, and I tell you what, I'm using the same editor called Emacs for editing stuff that I used in 1981. Hasn't changed a bit.
You know what's hilarious is that Gates had that experience. He entered right when punch card, I forget what university it was, but something out in California. They had just gotten rid of punch cards. The guy that runs Oracle, I mean, if you know, all these
it's
different...
It's very likely.
Anyway, so I just find it interesting.
Yeah,
but
it's very likely. And it's important. If you have a head start, it makes a difference. Right. If you're just walking into sort of programming...
Today, it's a lot of competition.
Yeah. Unless you're like 10 years old, right. Which a lot of people do.
It's true. So, you know, so it sounds like you have a business that's been around for a while, which is the hosting business, and this business is a little bit newer. And so, you know, what's it like running the two different businesses? They're very different products.
They are. The internet server company that was really a hosting company and is, although it's just a normal hosting company, one thing that is different from all the other hosting companies out there is that we do specialized hosting. And one of the things that I spoke to Pedro about it before it was that we had this huge account, and that's one of the reasons I left IBM, by the way. We had this account with Merrill Lynch Research where they have this application called Bara, which does securities. What it does is it actually optimizes securities to follow a certain trend, like let's say S&P 500. And it was very expensive to pay for these licenses. So Merrill Lynch Research asked us to develop, do a research. I've done a lot of optimization. So they asked me to do optimization of up to about 35,000 securities worldwide, real time, which is a very sparse system. So let's say you have $100,000 in your portfolio and you want to follow the S&P 500. How would you distribute this? Mm-hmm. And you have to do this real time. So what they wanted to do is they wanted to use this for their brokers. Mm-hmm. They have a lot of brokers who would sort of worldwide log into this thing and not pay the, you know, huge amounts of money that they were paying for the licensing of Vara. So we started working on it in 2000 when I left IBM. And by 2001, we actually had in a year an application which was doing this optimization and getting the same results as Vara was getting. Hmm. So it was a hosting company, but really we're doing these specialized, you know, algorithmic stuff.
Interesting.
And but what happened is, so in, the reason I finally sort of cut the cord in February of 2001 is because we had this huge contract. We were added as the 10th company on the list of vendors. You know, they had nine companies they could work with in Merrill Lynch. They had to add us, a small company, to be able to work with us for this because it was really important to them. And unfortunately, in September of 2001, when they hit the Twin Towers, these guys were in the thankfully they weren't hurt because they were in the World Financial Center, but it was right next door.
Yeah.
So the group was dismantled. You know, everybody went off a different direction.
Oh, wow.
There were like nine people in the group, so we had no contacts anymore. We had no idea where to even who to bill anymore.
Wow.
And so we still got our money until December, but the whole thing was gone. So December of 2001, we lost that contract, and that's when I really decided. Well, we lost that research, and I'm really a researcher at heart. So I said, you know what? I was doing this research at IBM. Why don't I just continue doing the same? You know, I'll just do that research. I don't want to go back, but I want to do the same research. So I started sort of doing speaker recognition again.
When you talk about research and you talk about IBM and then a small company, right away, I just informally think that the resources at a larger company from a research point of view would be more advantageous, but obviously your decision was the exact opposite.
Yes.
So talk about that.
Yeah, that's very important, actually. I was sort of a black sheep in IBM also. When I was at IBM Research, they have all these sort of confinements. They had just bought Lotus Notes. They were forcing everybody to use Lotus Notes, and they had to use Windows and all that. And I was the only person who had a Linux box in 96 in my office. And I had everything. I ported our whole speech thing to Linux just to be able to work on Linux because I just didn't want to use Windows. It was just too confining for me. And at that time, I was actually blacklisted from working ever on OS, on operating systems in IBM because they were worried about this open source business. And they sort of figured that out.
So they thought you would figure out that and then put it in open source.
Now they're in open source. But that was in 96.
That was a very strategic decision for them. They held out for quite a while.
They did. They were scared of the agreements and all that.
See, so, the black sheep. You know,
I was.
Well, back to what you say, how the entrepreneurial characteristics don't necessarily
But to get to this is, I'll give you examples. You know, I love IBM. I still have relations with them. But give you an example. For example, we had a lot of data. We wanted to get some hard drives, and SCSI drives are SCSI drives. It doesn't matter who you buy it from. IBM had this green money versus blue money, which is green being real money, blue being IBM money, internal money, that you had to buy IBM drives and stuff like that. So, and there was a list, waiting list for it. So we needed space right at that time. We needed over terabytes of space in like 99, 2000.
That's a lot of space. Then.
You were working with speech.
Yeah.
So you need a lot of space.
Yeah.
And I figured out with, $50,000, I can get that, you know, the space that we need. But then it would cost us, a few hundred thousand dollars if we wanted to do it within IBM because we have to spend blue money. So, and there was all this resistance. So there's all these political things that I didn't have to deal with when I came out.
Sure.
I was still working on a regular PC in my group, and our group was actually two people. Mm-hmm. Our speaker recognition group was two people. I was doing most of the technical work, there was a manager as well. So if you think about it, in fact, there were limitations to the resources. Because when I got out, I was able to buy whatever laptop or PC that I wanted, just put Linux on it, which was open source and free, and have no restrictions, you know, buy the cheapest SCSI drive I can put my hand on. So in fact, within a month or two, I had much more resources than I had at IBM. And in fact, our group was growing, and that was I was seeing that as a limitation, because what happens as you as the number of people grow, it's harder in the communication. A lot of things get lost, especially if you're trying to you know, design something, and if you're a good coder and you code it yourself, you can get it out fast. I'll give you an example. I was just at a very historical meeting at IBM Research. They had invited all the directors of research from 1952 up to today.
Seven directors
sitting right next to each other in the auditorium. I was picked out of the alumni to go and you know, be there in that occasion. So these people got up and started talking, and you know, one of the people who was whose tenure was at the same time that I was at IBM, one of the directors, was actually there, and I went to talk to him. One of the nice things is that you can actually go and talk to these people. And I said, well, now I'm in, I have a lot of your signatures on my wall. And started sort of breaking the ice. And then I said, you know, I have this company, speaker recognition company, that I'm doing the same thing that I was doing at IBM. And he said, well, how big is the company? And I said, well, it's about three people. He said, that's the right size. Now, this is a director, IBM director. If you know what you're doing, if it's a research-oriented thing, and if you don't really need... See, the type of research that we do is really software research. So we don't need, like, a DNA sequencing machine. We don't need... All we need is just a PC and a quiet place to go sit and read and do research. So... and because of my ties with Columbia, I have access to all the publications that I need, probably better than what I had in IBM.
Okay,
so, so there's all that as well. So really, you have everything that you need, and you don't have all those meetings every day for 2 hours trying to.
So I'm sure there's a lot of eye rolling going on.
Take
now.
Out all that. That's a lot of fat. Actually,
those meetings are very difficult.
They are,
because
they are.
They can sap the lifeblood out of you.
Yes. So I think that's part. I've been much more productive. Much more. I mean, way more productive.
Are you going to keep the company at three people, or are you going to? What's the future?
I don't know. Right now, there are a lot of companies who are actually looking into our products. There are a lot of large corporations, some government corporations, evaluating our products. We're at a point at that sort of crossroad that we have the product ready. It's a real product. Mm-hmm. It's not just a research sort of plaything. And in fact, we just had a demo in speech tech at the speech tech conference in New York, and there was so much noise. They had packed about 200 people in a room about 20 by 20. And noise is the worst thing, as you know, for speech products. We were doing great. You know, our speaker recognition system was picking up almost everybody. We were doing, I don't know, about 80, 90% accuracy in that environment.
Wow.
So, in fact, a lot of people, some of the big companies actually didn't show their products because it was just too noisy. huge companies. I'm not going to name them. But we did very well in that environment. So it's a real product. It's not just a research-oriented thing. So what I'm thinking is, if we get enough interest that we need to have a development team to just make it look nicer and stuff like that, we're probably going to grow it in that capacity.
Okay.
But research, core research, if it gets too big, you basically lose the whole research.
So you are looking to maintain that research balance. But then if you, and when you, to be optimistic, end up having a hit product, then the sales, the management.
Yeah, that stuff I want to. One of the things that I'm interested in actually is to do a lot of OEM. You know, just find companies who are interested in taking this,
let
putting their mark on it.
That's smart.
So you're just licensing it to them,
right,
essentially.
We just want to do research.
You want to do research.
And we get a cut on the licenses.
Right.
It's a
great
model,
too. They'll deal
with
the customers. They'll deal with
the
marketing.
Right, it's a great business model. You get your number. And
well, I think one of the important things in niche businesses is staying focused on what you know. And
exactly.
You know,
right.
You know, research and speaker recognition, and you know, you have not spent 30 years on, you know, on marketing and sales, at least
exactly.
from you know, unless I'm missing something.
No, you're right.
Yeah.
We don't really have any marketing at all at this point. Everything we've seen has been, I mean, people who are evaluating our, over 15 companies actively are evaluating our software right now. And this started just in the past couple of months. And they all found us either on the internet or through word of mouth. So There are only a handful of companies in the world that do what we do. Some of them are really, really large, mm-hmm. And some of them are not well liked. I won't name them. And and just people decide that they want to go with somebody they can. These are a lot of these things are sort of research oriented at heart. So if you have your own special problem, you want to go directly to the person who's designed the algorithms. You don't want to go to like this mass.
Well, I think right now there's also a backlash and fear against the big companies like Microsoft and Google because they have so much control that people are fearful. And I don't know if those are on the list of what you're talking about, but I've seen a backlash against those companies because, you know, if I'm, you know, Oracle, I don't want Google in my backyard, you know.
Actually, there seems to be a lot of turf fighting where people had their own domains, yeah.
That
and
is
now they're
true,
starting to bleed.
What I'm pointing at most is that there's a lot of legacy issues that large companies bring about with them.
Mm.
That, you know, we have to... And what they try to do is they try to sell their own hardware, their own OS to you. You can't just go to them and say, you know what, I have this specific problem. I need an engine. I know how to write an interface. What we do is we say, we just have this engine with a very simple interface. It runs in parallel processing and all that. Here's the very simple interface. Give us the audio. Give us the idea of the person. We'll give you back the results. Or give us the audio. We'll tell you who it is. As simple as that. So that then we say, you know, other companies should just take this and run it. And the thing is, patents are issues. Most patents are not algorithmic based. In fact, you can't legally patent algorithms, but most companies, large companies, do. I don't know how they get around it, but the thing is, in that sense, we don't have to deal with patents either because there's no user interface that we're working on. We're working on the core technology.
You know, it sounds like your company's really on the verge of doing some pretty exciting things. With you know, it sounds like the technology's working. You just got to find, you know, a few people to license it to, and you're going to be off to the races.
That's true. Yeah, we're
so,
at that level.
So anyway, we need to wind things down. So you know, Homayoun, it's been really fun talking to you this morning.
Likewise, thank you very much.
And
it's been really fun.
You know, be sure to visit his website, which is www.recognitiontechnologies.com. And if you're looking for speaker recognition, you got to give him a call because obviously he knows what he's talking about.
Obviously, exactly.
I appreciate the chance to speak to you and the people.
Absolutely. So,
yeah, thank you very much. That was really interesting.
Pedro, enjoyed your company as always.
Craig, have a good day. Stay dry.
And this is Greenwich Entrepreneurs Podcast, and we will see you again next time.